Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing here in Geneva. Today is Friday, 21st of February. I will start this, sorry for the delay. I will start the briefing with, unfortunately, an announcement that our dear friend and dean of the journalist accredited to the UN office at Geneva, Mrs. Lisa Schlein, our correspondent of Voice of America since 1981. Passed away at the beginning of this week. We all felt that we wanted to remember Lisa, who's a good friend of, I think, of all of us. So at the end of this briefing, we will be able to say a few words about her and remember her. And I am really glad to single out the children of Lisa who are here with us today. We will speak at length about the impressive record of Lisa and her compassionate and attachment for compassion and attachment for truth and what I could say we could call real reporting, truthful reporting, and a love for truth that she had, and we will speak about that at the end of this briefing. So I'll start now with our regular announcements. I would like to start with the announcement of the trip of the Secretary General, who will arrive in Geneva this weekend, and he will take part in the opening of the 58th session of the Human Rights Council, which is, as you know, scheduled to kick out on Monday morning. We'll hear more from Pascal in a moment. He will also speak to the high-level segment of the conference on disarmament in the afternoon. And he will hold a number of bilateral meetings. We will keep you informed in writing about his precise agenda. Maybe on the council, Pascal, you have got more.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. Just a few housekeeping notes to remind you that the opening of the 58th session will begin at 9 a.m. on Monday. The doors of room 20 will open at 8:30 a.m. sharp, so 30 minutes before the start of the meeting. So I strongly advise you to come in early before 8:30, especially those of you who have audiovisual equipment, so that you can secure entrance and space inside room 20. There will be a spillover room for those who cannot enter the room, and this spillover room is room 18. The running order for the opening of this 58th session, you will have the President of the Human Rights Council, followed by the President of the General Assembly, the Secretary General of the UN, and the High Commissioner for Human Rights. And after this opening, you will have the first state to speak will be Switzerland. The Foreign Minister, as the representative of the host country, will traditionally speak first. And the high-level segment will continue until 4 p.m. There won't be any lunch break on the first day of this session. At the end of the day, we'll have a panel discussion, the first one from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. That will be on the 30th anniversary of the Beijing Declaration and Platform of Action. Will participate in this panel the Secretary General, the High Commissioner, the President of the General Assembly, and the Chair of the Committee for the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. The Executive Director of UN Women will also participate through a video statement. And on Tuesday morning, you will have a second panel discussion on the question of the death penalty. So that's it for me. I sent you an email earlier this morning with all the latest updates regarding the A to Z guide, the program of work, the list of reports, the description of the 9 panels, and the list of dignitaries for the high-level segment. Just bear in mind that this list of dignitaries will be updated until Monday morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pascal. Is there any burning question? No, I don't see any. I see Antonio. Antonio, go ahead. Antonio, you have to unmute yourself. We can't hear you. Okay, now you're on. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to be sure that there won't be any limits to enter with cameras in the high-level segment.
No, there won't be any limitation for accredited journalists with audiovisual equipment, but since all journalists will be subject to security screening, those of you who bring cameras, and audiovisual equipment. So that's why I strongly advise you to come early to the door of room 20.
Thank you very much. Gorgi.
Bonjour, tout le monde. D'abord, ma compassion pour notre collègue et sa famille. Je souhaiterais savoir si le secrétaire général va tenir une conférence de presse normale, régulière, enfin, avec la presse durant sa visite pour le Conseil des droits de l'homme. La deuxième question...
Allez-y, Gorky. Je vais répondre.
La deuxième question, j'ai remarqué d'habitude quand il y a une personnalité d'un de nos pays, parfois il y a un peu plus de souplesse par rapport aux journalistes des pays pour pouvoir prendre des photos directement ou faire le travail, d'autant plus qu'évidemment, c'est de leur pays dont il s'agit et que l'intérêt est beaucoup plus puissant. J'ai eu à remarquer une fois durant la présence d'une autorité sénégalaise qu'une de vos collègues m'avait maltraité dans la salle. J'espère que cette manière de faire discriminatoire ne va pas se reproduire. Je vous remercie.
Merci Gorky. Sur votre première question, oui, le secrétaire général va tenir un briefing, mais off the records, on va vous envoyer l'information. Pour ce qui concerne cet accident auquel vous vous référez, je m'excuse si ça a été le cas, c'était sûrement pas intentionnel, mais parfois ça arrive dans les jours de grand stress et vraiment on fera attention à que ça se répète pas et je suis désolée si vous avez ressenti cela. Merci Pascal. J'irai maintenant très rapidement justement en Afrique où nous avons les représentants. Sorry, I switched to English. UNHCR representative in Burundi who was brought to us by Olga. Sorry, Olga Sarrado. And we welcome Mrs. Brigitte Mukanga Eno to hear about the appeal that the UNHCR is launching today on the situation in DRC and its impact on Burundi. Go ahead, madam.
Good morning, and thanks for having me today. The escalating situation, security situation in the DRC has been having a serious impact on the Burundi side. Over the past few weeks, we have observed a large number of people of Congolese who have been crossing into Burundi. And we have been working with the government of Burundi to receive the people who are crossing. Mainly, we have two main points of entrance. You have those coming directly into Bujumbura, which is the official border point, but also those who, a bigger number of people who are crossing have been coming through the Rusizi River, which is the triangle border between Burundi, DRC, and Rwanda. And at the Rusizi River, we have received a bigger number of people. Currently, we are talking of more than 36,000 people who have crossed through the Rusizi border, while at the main entrance, the official, we have about 6,000 people who have crossed on this side. The government of Burundi has been generous enough, and we are very grateful for that, to keep the borders open and also to declare implementation of the prima facie recognition, which means that all those who are seeking protection in Burundi are automatically recognized as refugees in Burundi. The situation is difficult because this is the very first time that Burundi is receiving this large number of people in a matter of few days, because the increase in numbers really started on the weekend of the 14th, and we have seen last week on Tuesday, we had more than 9,000 people who crossed in one day. So this kind of large influx is really the first time in many years for Burundi. The last one was in the early 2000s. So everyone is overwhelmed, the government, but also the humanitarian actors in the country. We are trying our best, but the people who are arriving are coming quite in very, very bad shape, particularly for those coming through the Rusizi River, because from what they are telling us, many have been already displaced within within the Congo before crossing into Burundi. They say that some of them were around Goma and even in the southern Kivu around Bukavu, where some of those displaced camps have been dismantled, and they have been working for days, arriving in really a very bad shape. The other day we had even a case of a woman who was transporting her children and not knowing that they were already dead, actually, when she dropped them in the camp. Two of the children just passed on based on exhaustion. And so we have, the conditions are very bad for the people who are arriving. We have mostly women and so many children, so many children. And elderly people, the young persons are not as many, but mostly women and children who are crossing in this border. Unfortunately, also the conditions for receptions are very limited. The government has allowed us to settle them for the moment in a stadium, in a Rugombo Stadium, which is just in the open air. And we have a few schools and churches that have also accepted to receive them for the moment. But these places are still very close to the border. And yesterday, no, the day before yesterday, the government declared, when the government declared the prima facie implementation for this population, they also decided to allocate land where we are going to start moving them and create a settlement which could also have all the necessary facilities. But for the moment, they are still at the stadium in Rugombo and in schools, as I mentioned. There are so many gaps. But of course, I said most humanitarian, we are trying to put in place an appropriate response, apart from the protection which is provided. The government, the Ministry of Health, working with WHO, we have been able, as of yesterday, to vaccinate all the children under 15 systematically because of two cases of measles that were identified as we're trying to do the medical screening. But also the water tanks have been put in place with UNICEF, trying to put just a few tanks have been put in place. And the WFP has also been able to deploy some food for us to make sure that we can provide hot meals to the people who are coming. But of course, the rations are very limited for the moment, considering this large number of people. We also, with MSF, there's a health clinic, a mobile clinic that has been established and which would continue because there are cases of people who are arriving being sick already and the malnutrition that is observed among the children, but also the psychosocial support for cases that have gone through a lot of violence in their country before reaching Burundi. So for the moment, we, as a humanitarian community, we have a contingency plan that was prepared ahead of as we situation. And the contingency plan is, we were targeting about 58,000 people who could cross, but for the moment we are already, we have already received more than 40,000. And we are calling for support, of course, from various donors. We have been, we are calling from donors to support all the missions because there's no sufficient resources within the country to manage this situation. I will pause there and
Thank you very much. I think Olga wants to complete with a few more information.
Thank you, Brigitte. And just to flag that while the movements elsewhere in the region have been smaller, around 15,000 new arrivals have been registered in neighboring countries since January, to Uganda, to Rwanda, to Tanzania, and others. So to respond to this worsening emergency, UNHCR is seeking $40.4 million to strengthen preparedness and deliver life-saving protection and assistance to 275,000 internally displaced people in South Kivu, North Kivu, Maniema, and Tanganyika provinces of the DRC, as well as to support a potential influx of 258,000 refugees, asylum seekers, and returnees in neighboring countries, including Burundi, Rwanda, Tanzania, Uganda, and Zambia. So in the note that you will receive, there are some maps. I think this can be helpful because the arrivals are reaching Burundi and neighboring countries from different entry points. And also you will have a link to B-roll, some footage from the border in Burundi. Back to you, Alessandra.
Thank you very much, both colleagues. I'll open the floor to question in the room. Nina Larsson is our correspondent of AFP.
Yeah. Hi, thank you for the briefing. I was hoping, it was a little bit unclear to me on the total number. I think it was, you said more than 40,000 earlier. I think it said 36 plus 6, so 42. If you could just clarify the exact number, and then also the time frame that they've fled. And when it comes to the contingency planning, could you also explain what the time frame is there, and if you think that 58,000 is a likely number, or if you think it could possibly be higher than that. Thank you very much.
Brigitte.
Thank you. The contingency plan, the maximum we were targeting was 58,000 people. We thought that would happen in a period like three months. But just for the first 2 weeks, we have received more than 36,000 in Rugombo, which is the border I mentioned, and 6,000 currently at the transit center close to Bujumbura, which makes it around 42,000 people already seeking asylum out of the 58 planned.
Thank you. Don't see other hands on in the room. So Gabriela Sotomayor, Processo.
Thank you, Alessandra. I have a question but on another subject, if it's possible.
Just wait a second, then. Let me see if there is any other. Yeah, you have a follow-up, Nina?
Yeah, sorry. So I was just wondering if you're revising your contingency plan then, given the speed with which the exodus is happening. Thank you.
Absolutely. We are working, all the teams are working closely, both at field level and in the government of Burundi, to review the contingency plan. Mais pour le moment, nous avons réellement besoin de commencer déjà à répondre à toutes ces personnes qui sont arrivées et surtout de pouvoir les éloigner de la frontière parce qu'ils sont trop proches de la frontière et nous avons des craintes de ce côté, qu'il y ait des incidents de sécurité de ce côté. Donc la priorité pour le moment, c'est de commencer une réponse adéquate par rapport à ces 42 000 personnes qui sont déjà au niveau de la frontière et du centre de transit.
Merci beaucoup. Gabriela, your question is on what? Is it for UNHCR?
Yes. Yes. So my question is on about United States. So I would like to know what is the situation of asylum seekers, refugees, principally refugees, in the United States, because they were prosecuted. I mean, they were a subject of persecution in the USA. So if you can tell me what is the situation, what if you are active there, if you know, if whatever you can say about that.
Olga.
Gabriela, I don't know exactly which is incidents specifically you are referring to, so maybe we can touch base and follow up in parallel. But of course, the U.S. Is a close partner for UNHCR, and they've been taking care and welcoming refugees throughout the years. So we expect that this continues. But I will follow up directly with you after the briefing.
Thank you very much. And I'd like to thank Brigitte also for being with us today from Bujumbura. Let me ask all the colleagues who are going to brief on Ukraine to come to the podium. OCHA, UNICEF, WHO, UN Women, I think, is online. Sophie is online. And then Charlotte. Where's Margaret? Oh, and I can't see Charlotte. Or maybe Charlotte is online too. Let me see. Oh, I can't see her. Okay, maybe Charlotte will join us a little bit later. So thank you very much, colleagues, for being here. As you know, we are getting very close to the third anniversary of the Russian aggression in Ukraine. And all colleagues would like to make a point of the situation there at this important anniversary. So we are also having online colleagues. Jens, you have come with the resident coordinator and humanitarian coordinator in Ukraine, Assistant Secretary General Matthias Schmale. Matthias, I welcome you to the briefing here in Geneva. James, you have brought Toby Fricker, who is UNICEF's Chief of Communication in Ukraine, and who's talking to us from Zaporizhia. Sorry, I forgot to say that Matthias is in Kyiv. And then Margaret, you are accompanied by Dr. Jarno Harbic. Our colleagues know him well. He's the WHO country representative for Ukraine. And Sophia Kaltop is here in Geneva for UN Women. And we will see if UNAIDS joins us later on. So maybe I'll start with OCHA. Jens, you want to say a word? And then we go to Matthias.
Yeah, thank you very much, Alessandra. And it's so good to see you, Matthias, there online. I will pass the floor to you, but just to say from here, thank you very much for taking time to speak to us. These are busy, uncertain times in Ukraine. I know you have a fantastic team there that you lead. So over to you for the latest.
Thank you, Alessandra and Jens. Good morning to you in Geneva. As has already been mentioned, on Monday, the 24th, is the third anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion into Ukraine, and it is a somber milestone. We should remember that for 3 years now, civilians in Ukraine have endured continuous attacks, displacement, and hardship. We must also remember that this began back in 2014. So all children that were born since, all children up to the age of 11, have never experienced their country at peace. In 2024, last year, there was a 30% increase in civilian casualties compared to the year before, and the humanitarian situation is arguably worsening. We think that 36%, so more than a third of Ukraine's population, 12.7 million people, need humanitarian assistance this year. Winter makes everything more hazardous and dangerous. It's getting very cold again. Last night it was -8 attacks Celsius here in Kyiv, and it's colder along the front line. Attacks on energy infrastructure risk leaving hospitals and homes without electricity and heating during these most cold months of the year. A few days ago in Mykolaiv in the south, 100,000 people were left without access to electricity, and there are other examples like this. Allow me to mention that going into the fourth year of war, there's also the hidden crisis of mental health. At the moment, there are attacks every night. This past night, all of us here in Kyiv were woken up yet again by air sirens and loud explosions. And this, of course, has a serious psychological impact. I sometimes call this psychological terror from the sky. And this is weakening resilience. We often speak of, I've seen enormous examples of strong people who get up and rebuild, but resilience is understandably weakening as this goes on. Now, allow me to mention that as humanitarian coordinator in Ukraine, I have identified and pushed the following four priorities for this year. The first line is to continue support along the front lines and delivering aid to some very vulnerable people who've chosen to stay near the front line. Last year, we had 50 convoys bringing 580 metric tons of essential supplies to war-torn communities, and we are continuing this into this year. The second priority is to support the management of evacuations from the frontline areas. There are, in particular, vulnerable people among the older people and people with limited mobility that face serious difficulties. There are very strong pushes by the armed forces of the Russian Federation along the front line, and evacuations are ongoing. We are supporting people with essential goods, including cash assistance, as they are on the move to transit centers, collective sites, and wherever they end up being. Allow me to also mention the other side of the front line, the occupied territories. We continue to have no real access to those, and we know, though, that there are some very vulnerable people in the occupied territories without support. The third priority is to continue supporting, in particular, local organizations who respond to strikes, to military activity. I have been to several impact sites. I've met many of the local first responders, and it is really impressive how quickly they often act. There's more than 600 national and local groups involved in this, and really with remarkable speed, often within the hour, they are on the scene helping people who've just lost homes or loved ones. And then finally, the fourth priority is ensuring, contributing to more durable solutions for IDPs, internally displaced people. There are more than 10 million people who've been uprooted by this war, and 3.7 million people are displaced within Ukraine. 3 years into the fourth year, this is becoming a protracted crisis going beyond the immediate humanitarian response. And government is increasingly talking to me and others about more durable solutions, including, of course, employment, social housing, access to healthcare and education. So let me finish by saying we, in order to implement these four priorities, this year we need $2.6 billion to sustain assistance in these around these priorities for at least 6 million people. So, of course, we urge the international community to continue to be generous. Ukraine must not be forgotten. We know the world's attention is divided, understandably, among multiple crises, but the humanitarian needs in Ukraine continue unabated and are urgent, and we need the support of the international community. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you so much, Matthias, for being with us. Stay there. We will open the floor to questions just in a moment. I'll go to UNICEF. James, you want to introduce Toby, or we'll give him the floor straight away? Okay. So, Toby, can you please brief us on the situation of children and the toll of war on them?
Good morning. Yes, absolutely. And let me talk to, to start by talking to a new survey that recently released. It shows that a staggering five children in Ukraine reported losing a close relative or friend since the escalation of the war 3 years ago. One in three children reported feeling so hopeless and sad that they can't do their usual activities. These are the responses of more than 23,000 children who took part in a UNICEF-led survey that we released today. And it's a blunt reminder of the loss and grief that pervades childhood in Ukraine. 3 years into the full-scale war, more than 2,520 children have been killed or injured, according to UN-verified numbers. The real number is likely far higher. And it's getting worse. There was a more than 50% increase in child casualties in 2024 compared to 2023. And what we see is no place is safe. Schools, maternity wards, children's hospitals, all have been affected by attacks. overall some 780 health facilities and more than 1,600 schools have been damaged or destroyed, according to UN data. In Odessa this week, we saw a health clinic providing care for 40,000 children, and a kindergarten serving 250 of the youngest children were severely damaged in an attack. When a children's hospital is hit, a school shelled or an electric grid destroyed, children suffer even when they survive. Their well-being and development impacted yet again. Schools, for example, are places for children to learn. They're lifelines that provide a sense of safety and normalcy, as we say, and hope for the future. Yet nearly 40% of children across Ukraine still study online or through a mixture of in-person and remote classes. Today, I'm talking to you from an underground school here in Zaporizhia. Classrooms in basements and shelters like these have sadly become the norm. This should not be the norm. The impact on education has been immense. Assessments have shown that on average, learning loss of 2 years in some subjects among some children. UNICEF has been supporting the rehabilitation of shelters to make them as safe and child-friendly as possible. We've been training teachers, establishing catch-up classes to help children recover learning losses. But the impact on children's development and mental health, as we just heard, is equally worrying. Let's not forget, as we also were just told, that children and young people across the East have lived through nearly 11 years of war. Like 18-year-old Darina, who I first met 5 years ago in Zolote, an eastern mining town close to the then front line. We recently reconnected near Dnipro, where she has been displaced. And she said, "You know, I had plans for the future, but the war ruined everything. Now the future doesn't exist." Those were her words. And there are still 3.7 million people internally displaced, the more than 6.8 million outside the country. In neighboring host countries, half of Ukrainian school-aged children are not enrolled in national education systems. And while children and young people of all ages are at risk, those born when the escalation of war began are now turning 3 years old. They've spent their critical early years, when brains develop the fastest and the foundation for life is set, amid extreme stress and loss. And that has long-term risks of psychological disorders, poorer physical health throughout life. The consequences can also be intergenerational, which is why early intervention is so critical, like UNICEF-supported mobile teams, including counselors who respond immediately after attacks, like home visits in frontline areas and other areas across the country that provide vital health and holistic care, such as identifying developmental challenges and providing parenting guidance. We know that when we invest in early childhood health and development, there is a longer-term return on investment of 9 to 1. Improving access to and the quality of such services will help create an environment also that people will want to return to. We've seen how, despite the extreme challenges Ukraine's children, youth and families, as well as extraordinary social and health workers, teachers, water technicians, have demonstrated incredible resolve. And we were working together with them, not only on our humanitarian response, but through development efforts. This underground school here in Zaporizhia is an initiative of the local authorities here, using best practices provided by UNICEF. The Better Care Reform agenda to ensure every child grows up in a family, not an institution, is not only happening in Western Ukraine, but here in frontline areas. Investing in children and young people across the country, as we say, is non-negotiable, not only because it's the right thing to do for their protection and well-being, but for the future of Ukraine. What's ultimately needed is a real and sustained peace in which every child can realize their rights. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I go now to WHO. Margaret, you want to start, or I go to Jarno? Jarno, please go ahead with your briefing.
Dear colleagues in Geneva and journalists, just to build on the two previous colleagues sharing, imagine a young mother in Kharkiv region in Ukraine, her days interrupted by air raid sirens and her nights haunted by drones. Each day is a struggle balancing her children's safety with the anxiety that has become her constant companion. In 2017, 2 years ago, when the health reform started, 1 out of 10 people in Ukraine say psychological stress was negatively impacting their health. Now, 3 years into the war, Most recent survey shows that that number is 6 out of 10 people, 60%. Let's come back to Kharkiv. Among her many daily concerns, one is about access to and the affordability of healthcare. Will the local primary healthcare clinic be open? And will the doctor be available? And the young mother afford the care that the child needs? Will the pharmacy have the medicine that her elderly parents require for chronic diseases? She's not unique. According to the latest WHO Health Needs Assessment, 25% of people believe their access to medical services has worsened compared to the period before February 24, 2022 and Russian Federation invasion. 82% have experienced issues getting medicines, mainly due to the price increase. And 35% of population are postponing their care, every third person. And what about the young woman's husband who has just returned home with a traumatic life-altering injury? Will he get the rehabilitation he needs and how he can return to work? This is the reality for countless families across Ukraine 3 years into the devastating invasion. The regional disparities persist in public health picture, what we are seeing, with areas of increased vulnerability and conflict-affected areas, with greater difficulties due to the security concerns and higher cost of care and medicines. It is often said how resilient the Ukrainian people are, but however resilient, they shouldn't face these difficult choices. Neither should health be a target. Since the start of the full-scale war, WHO has documented over 2,200 attacks on health, and it is ongoing. Earlier this week, an overnight strike in Odessa damaged the region's largest children's clinic, disrupting vital services. And many of you have seen and witnessed the pictures. It isn't just about buildings. It's about lives disrupted, care denied, futures put on hold. And it is about the immense pressure on healthcare workers exhausted by heroically working 24/7. Dear partners, this year in 2025, an estimated 9.2 million people in Ukraine will need some form of health assistance from humanitarian actors. And Matthias was mentioning the whole appeal and the many sectors need support. With the support of WHO and our partners, we aim to reach 3 million people, mainly in the frontline areas, focusing the most critical needs in the oblasts impacted. We collectively need over $130 million to continue to save lives the way how we have been doing the last 36 months. Despite the challenges, we have witnessed the health system transformation and recovery during the last 3 years. This is due to extraordinary complementary financing and financial support, such as budget support, investments, expertise, and capacity building for health sector from many donors, including European Union. We acknowledge these partnerships and funding and gratefully ask you to continue. The health of Ukraine's people will depend on this. Dear journalists, we mark 3 year full-scale war. It is WHO and the wider UN family's role to continue the support to Ukraine with response, recovery, and development efforts. They all go hand in hand. Amid of destruction, our commitment is everywhere. In Mykolaiv, we support to have clean water and sanitation in hospitals. In Zaporozhye, I was just talking to many mental health experts and the colleagues working to support with those invisible wounds that many have mentioned. In Kharkiv, we have just opened a heating station to ensure that the hospital can work. And we have trained more than 8,000 healthcare workers on emergency care. The rehabilitation services are gradually scaled up. I witnessed that in Dnipro last week in Hospital 16, where services are available and the new healthcare workers are trained. And we met with hundreds of rehab colleagues in Kiev last week on the Rihab Forum to ensure that all the work across the Ukraine is coordinated. The health financing team is working to make primary care affordable, and especially in the rural and war-affected areas, together with the National Health Service of Ukraine. These are just few glimpses of our work in Ukraine, in all the oblasts and various facilities. Dear all, going ahead, we need stamina, solidarity, and support more than ever. The people of Ukraine are counting on us. And ultimately, health may not be everything, but without health, everything is nothing. Dziękuję.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. I'll close with Sophia Kaltrop for UN Women. Charlotte had to disconnect, but she has sent you her notes for UNAIDS. Sophia, you're calling in from Geneva.
Thank you very much, Alessandra. Good morning to everybody. And it's an honor to be here with colleagues from the rest of the UN system as we mark this sombering 3 years. As we all know, we meet at a critical moment for Ukraine, where the war continues to take an unimaginable toll on, in particular, the lives of millions of women and girls of Ukraine. And behind the headlines, beyond the battlefield, there is another story unfolding, and that is the story of all those women and girls who are bearing the brunt of this war, but yet they are standing resilient, leading their communities and working towards a better future for all Ukrainians. And as we mark this 3 years since the beginning of the full-scale war, I would like to shed some light on the realities and the struggles and hardship, but also leadership of the women and girls of Ukraine, and to reaffirm UN Women's very strong commitment to supporting them. As we have said before, the full-scale war has pushed an entire generation of Ukrainian women and girls backward in terms of rights, in terms of safety, and in terms of economic opportunities. We have already heard from Matthias that in 2024, the number of killed and injured in Ukraine increased by a staggering 30%, and of those 800 women lost their lives, and more than 3,700 women were killed last year, were injured in Ukraine. We also know that the vast majority of Ukrainian refugees and displaced persons are women, and 6.7 million women are in need of life-saving humanitarian assistance. Women's access to key health, energy, and education services is compromised, with over half of the country's primary healthcare facilities damaged or destroyed. As we also heard, the UN is not able to access occupied parts of Ukraine, but I would like to stress our concern about the plight of women in detention and their vulnerability to sexual violence. The UN has already verified 398 cases of conflict-related sexual violence perpetrated by Russian forces so far. Since 2023, the cases of domestic violence have surged by staggering 36% in Ukraine. War-related distress has contributed to this increase in gender-based and domestic violence, and as well as to the higher rates of depression among women and girls. And we already heard colleagues briefing about the hidden mental crisis in Ukraine. And also, when it comes to this mental health crisis, women and girls are in the midst of the suffering. Further, women in Ukraine do not have equal access to the economy. In 2023, women made up 72.5% of the unemployed. And by 2024, only 48% of displaced women were employed, compared to 71% of men. Women also earned 41.4% less than men in 2023, which is a doubling of the pay gap in Ukraine since 2021. Unpaid care and domestic work have also sharply risen, with the closure of childcare facilities has worsened the burden on women in terms of domestic unpaid care work. But despite all those hardships, the Ukrainian women are showing extraordinary leadership. They are driving economic recovery, leading humanitarian efforts, and even enlisting themselves in the armed forces in record numbers. Today, we have more than 68,000 women that have joined the armed forces of Ukraine, with 5,000 actively serving in combat roles at the moment. But yet, the women of Ukraine remain severely underfunded. In 2022, less than 1% of all international aid in support of recovery in Ukraine included a gender equality focus. Since the start of the full-scale war, we at UN Women have been at the forefront, providing life-saving assistance to women and girls across Ukraine, from humanitarian aid and psychosocial support to economic and political empowerment initiatives. We are working tirelessly together with our partners in Ukraine to ensure that women and women's organizations are not left behind. In 2024 alone, we supported more than 180,000 women and girls affected by the war. And for the Women, Peace and Humanitarian Fund, we have directed over 20 million US dollars to 54 women-led and women's rights organizations operating mainly in the hardest hit areas of the country. But let me finally stress that our work at UN Women, it's not only about meeting immediate needs. It's also about securing women's access to rights, strengthening their participation in decision-making, and ensuring that they have a strong voice in shaping Ukraine's future. Because we know that no lasting peace in Ukraine without women at the table is possible. History has shown us that peace agreements are more durable and inclusive when women are involved. This is not just a matter of fairness, it is a matter of effectiveness. And I would like to take this opportunity as we mark the 3 year of the start of the war and the upcoming 30th anniversary of the Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action to call on all partners and decision makers for renewed financial and political support to the women's rights organizations and to the women leaders in Ukraine to deliver humanitarian assistance, to participate in early recovery, and also to engage in peace processes. We cannot fail the women and girls of Ukraine right now. If we stand together, we can ensure that women and girls are not only survivors of this war, but that they emerge from it stronger, empowered, and leading the way forward for a just and equal future for all Ukrainians. Thank you very much. Thank you, Alessandra, and over to you.
Thank you, Sofia. And if Lisa Schlein was still with us, she would ask all our speakers to send their notes. So I'll do it for her. Please send in your notes to the journalist. I'll open the floor to questions. There is also some in the chat, but I'll start with the room. Christian Ulrich is our correspondent of the German news agency and a good friend of Lisa.
Yes, for more than 30 years. My question is to Matthias Schmale, Deutsche Presseagentur. Guten Tag, Herr Schmale. You were mentioning the mental health, and others were also mentioning mental health. What do the latest news out of Washington and the denigration of the Ukrainian president and the new developments do to the mental health of people that you meet in Kiev? Thank you.
Matthias?
Yeah, thank you for the question. Unsurprisingly, the mood is very somber here, and it is not just the three-year mark, it is also what is happening globally. I sense that people are hopeful that the weapons will fall silent. You know, who wouldn't want that, given all the horror that my colleagues and I have described? But what is clear also is that the citizens of Ukraine want justice. And I think the main worry in terms of the latest developments around ending the war are that justice falls off the table. That's what worries people. It's not just the guns falling silent, but will there be a just future for everyone? And unsurprisingly, if that weighs on your mind in addition, to the nightly strikes that are going on, mental health will further deteriorate.
Absolutely. If any colleague want to add anything, just show your hand. Other questions? Yes. I don't know if everybody knows you. It's our new correspondent of Reuters.
Thank you. Yeah. Hi, it's Olivia Lepodova from Reuters. Thanks, everybody, for this briefing. Two questions. One thing that other organizations have been noting is that Ukrainians who have been displaced both internally and outside the country are facing grave financial difficulty. Some are being forced to return to Ukraine, some to dangerous areas. Is that something across the panel here today have been noting as well and have been seeing? And are there any further details you can maybe give on that? And secondly, to that point of funding, you've all highlighted some pretty serious concerns about the challenge ahead. Obviously, we're going into a climate of funding freezes. How concerned are you about the year ahead and whether you're going to have the sufficient means to meet the needs on the ground? Thank you.
Who would like to take this? I'm looking at the platform, Jarno, Sofia, Matthias. Matthias, maybe you want to start? And then...
Sure thing.
Also, Jarno, those who want to speak, please show me, because I can't see who wants to answer. Just go ahead, please, Matthias. Then Sofia.
Thank you. Thank you, Alessandra. For sure, financial difficulties are increasing. I remember when recently Tom Fletcher, the emergency relief coordinator, and Filippo Grandi, the High Commissioner for Refugees, visited the Prime Minister, whom they met, spoke at length about this. He mentioned that since 22, 3.5 million jobs have been lost. You know, that's a staggering volume of jobs and is one indication of how difficult things are. We are in this context then very worried that cash assistance seems to be excluded from the assistance that the Americans may consider reopening for Ukraine and in other places of the world. When you have increasing poverty against the background of a dire economic situation, people need all the support they can get, and cash is a major form of support that allows people to buy the most urgent needs and to do so with dignity. We are, of course, worried about the funding freezes. As we all know, it's not the end of the day yet. There are a lot of discussions going on. We have some of our partners, including within the UN, have received some exemptions from the general freeze of funding, but so far no money has been flowing as a result of those exemptions. So we hope that US funding will become part of the equation. If it doesn't, last year it made up 30% of what we spent on the humanitarian side, 10% on the development side. So of course we're in the middle of not trying to understand the impact in these turbulent times, but also to see what we can do to compensate if the funding doesn't come back, or at least not to the extent we need it. And we are in constant discussions with government that is setting priority, as well as other partners, notably from the EU.
Thank you. I see Sofia would like to add something, and then Jarno.
Thank you, yeah. Alessandra. Thank you. Just to note, the question on returnees, just to note that over 76% of all returnees to Ukraine are women and girls. So also, of course, in terms of the situation with returnees, we think there is a need to look at the specific needs for women and girls. In terms of the funding, let me just stress again, you know, the severe funding conditions for women, local women-led organizations that are very often, at the very front line at UN Women. We are very grateful for the funding that we've received, the $20 million that we've been able to disperse to frontline responders for the Women, Peace and Humanitarian Fund. But again, a staggering less than 1% of international aid for early recovery is having a gender lens on it. So for us, really, to as Matthias said, we have a severe underfunding of the crisis overall. But within that, the situation for women-led organizations and the gender perspective is really something that we think need to be highlighted. Thank you very much, Alessandra.
Thank you, Jarno.
Thank you. And just to add also what Matthias and Sofia were mentioning, I think first, what we have seen over the last 3 years, that affordability for medical care and medicines becomes more of an issue. And it is very good that you mentioned also what's happening related to the internally displaced persons. We see that they have usually lower access to care and also less means to have access to medicines or services. So what we have been doing is scaling up the vaccination programs for them, ensuring that the services are more available, having the dialogue to ensure that IDPs have access to care. And we are not the only ones. I think Matthias and many other partners, we're doing the same to ensure, because we need to look also that the poverty levels have increased tremendously several times during the war, and people have less means available. And on financing, I would say Ukraine has been very resilient because there is a complementary financing of humanitarian budget support, as well development projects and recovery projects and investments. And it is important that all of those will continue, so that we need to look how they complementary have helped Ukraine to be resilient and be sure that also government services are available across the country. I'm looking particularly health services, but the same way the teachers continue to teach, the doctors continue to work, the social workers are available. And this is because of tremendous support. And personally, I'm more concerned how all that complementary financing will continue, something that we discussed in March and April 2022. Now it's a very critical time to see that all of that is continuing. Thank you.
Toby, I'll give you the floor, but also maybe when you answer, you can also answer the question from BBC in the chat. Imogen Fox is asking you if you could repeat the estimate of the number of children killed and eventually share the notes of this survey. Thank you, Toby.
Thanks so much. Yeah, just to build really on what Jana was just saying, is we, you know, yesterday, for example, I was in Dnipro, and this is about providing the services at a local level, community level, where we also, you know, in some ways injecting into the economy. So we have a social workers hub, training hub in Dnipro, and these are social workers who are out right out in the communities, rural areas, near the frontline areas. But also a new program that's just kicking in now, where it's a small grants program. So it's about supporting community-based services so the healthcare system can really build on that and use that training, not just for now, but in the long run. And I think that's, you know, that kind of works absolutely critical for people who, as you mentioned in the question, are returning to certain areas you know, across the country, about building that service, as I referred to in my remarks, around being able to provide the early childhood development and the holistic care for children, not just children, but for people as a whole. And on the numbers of children killed, the latest we had was more than 2,520 killed or injured. But I can certainly follow up with the specifics on that and the share the notes, etc. in the survey.
Thank you very much. That was from BBC. So Jamie Keaton, Associated Press.
Thank you. Thank you, Alexandra. You mentioned at the beginning, sorry, did you want to go first? Okay. Just this question is for either for you or for Mr. Schmela. Hopefully he will chime in. You mentioned at the very beginning of this section about Ukraine that you used the term Russian aggression in Ukraine. There's been some report. What's that? I think you used the word aggression, but anyway, that issue is being discussed about a communique for the G7, and there's been some reporting that maybe the term Russian aggression may be lifted from a joint statement on Monday. Presumably you're aware of that. So I just wanted to clarify what the UN position is, either from you or from Mr. Schmela, about the term Russian aggression in Ukraine. Is that actually the position of the United Nations? Thank you.
Maybe my tongue is fourché, as they say in French, but I was referring to this anniversary as the third year anniversary since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and 11 years, well, this I didn't say, but I say now, 11 years since the illegal annexation of the Autonomous Republic of Crimea and city of Sebastopol. I don't know if Matthias would like to add anything. Can't see him, so possibly. Yes. No, you were saying no with your hand, or yes?
Let me just a quick
go ahead.
A quick reflection. Thank you, Alessandro. I think as UN, we have been very clear that the full-scale invasion in 22 violated the UN Charter and the territorial integrity of Ukraine. That's what's important, whether we call it an aggression or something else. It's a violation of what the UN stands for in terms of territorial integrity and the values enshrined in our charter.
Absolutely, and the Secretary General has repeated several times that his position is that he wants to see an end to this conflict in line with General Assembly resolutions, the territorial integrity of Ukraine, and international law. Sorry, Bez, I didn't see you. Sorry, let's go to Bez. I always try to give the floor first to those who make the effort of being here. And today there are many people because of our friend Lisa, but I give you the floor first, and then we go to Gabriele.
No worries. Good morning, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for this briefing. I just want to return to UNICEF and ask Toby if he can give us a better understanding of what this U.S. funding cuts meaning regarding the education efforts in Ukraine. He already mentioned the severe impact of the war and what it means such funding to keep schools running, the education running in the Ukraine. Is there still, is there any impact already, or which programs would it impact? Thank you.
Thank you, Toby. Beyza is our correspondent of the Turkish News Agency.
Thanks so much for the question. I think the impact was already just referenced to by the resident coordinator. But I can talk in terms of education. What I can say is the government is committed to education. The government has put an extraordinary amount of budget into the education system. And as I referenced earlier, I'm here, you know, in this school, this underground school, which is an initiative of the authorities. UNICEF supports in different ways. But really, the commitment to education is across the country here. There's a realization, of course, that the future of Ukraine, of course, as we say, is a cliche that relies on the children. But it really does. And it's about building the skills, not only in the early years to set that lifelong journey of education, but also among adolescents, teenagers, when they're looking now to their futures. You know, what are the skills, the relevant skills that they need to build to for the jobs of today, of tomorrow? And that's absolutely critical for the development of the country. You know, and UNICEF, we're here to be able to provide that support to catch up classes, to support with shelters like we have done in some areas. And that work goes on as best we can.
Thank you very much. You have a follow-up?
So does that funding cut will have any impact on it, or without it or with it, it's going to continue in the same dedication you're trying to say?
Yeah, I mean, of course, the funding cuts have an impact on UNICEF, on everyone. And right now, as was referred, it's still, you know, an evolving picture. But in terms of education, we have other resources that we're using. We have resources that are already committed. And we continue to support the education system as a whole. So that technical support, the policy level support, as well as on the ground where we can, in terms of the catch-up classes, in terms of other work around, you know, turning around those learning losses that have been the case, not just for 3 years, but for longer during COVID and before that across the east of Ukraine.
Thank you very much. Gabriela, this time is your turn.
Thank you, Alessandra. Well, I have been waiting a lot, so I want to ask, are you going to be invited to the meeting between Mr. Putin and Mr. Trump? Are you going to be, I mean, the UN organizations are going to brief them about the situation? Because I don't know, I mean, they didn't invite Ukraine, but I would like to know if they invited you in any level. And then I would like to know, President Trump said that Mr. Zelensky is a dictator. So do you agree with this term? I think he was elected in a democratic elections. So I would also like to know what is your opinion on that. And if you can answer, and I think I have another question. Thank you.
On what? On Ukraine?
On Ukraine.
What is your last question, Gabriela, on Ukraine?
Yes. Mr. Trump said that Ukraine is guilty of the invasion, that they were guilty. I would like to know your opinion. I mean, it was like a full-scale invasion. How they can be guilty of that? If you can clarify that, or what is your opinion on that? Thank you.
Okay, so very quickly, on your last question, I think if you listen to what we have said, and I think Matthias also repeated it, I think you understand from yourself what it means, who are we looking at in terms of invasion. Hmm? And on the participation in the negotiations, I think you will be the first to know if and when we will be invited. What I can tell you is that when Mr. Miroslav Yenka, a couple of days ago, I think he was in the council, spoke about the situation in Ukraine, he called for a dialogue to end the conflict, a dialogue that will obviously need to involve both Russia and Ukraine. And I don't know if anybody wants to add something. I'm looking at Matthias, but don't think so. So if there are no... Oh, okay. Mohamed, the other correspondent of the Turkish news agency. Mohamed, go ahead.
Alessandra, my question is for Margaret, but on Gaza.
If there are no other questions on Ukraine, let's go to Gaza. I'd like to finish the briefing in 10 minutes so we can talk about Lisa. Yes, go ahead, please.
Okay. Thank you so much. Margaret, as you remember, WHO DG, Mr. Tedros, has shared a tweet and that the polio vaccination campaign in Gaza is planned to begin on February 22. My question is, have your preparation been complete for this? And as WHO and other partners contacted with Israeli authorities, will a vaccination program begin tomorrow? Thank you.
Thanks, Mohammed. Yes, indeed. All the preparations are underway. WHO, also UNICEF, are very much involved in vaccination, polio vaccination campaigns, all vaccination campaigns. And even though, indeed, it has been had to be done in a quite speedy manner, we are indeed doing all the necessary preparations.
Okay, thank you very much. So let me free our colleagues on the ground. Matthias Schmale from Kyiv. Matthias, thank you so much for being with us today to talk about us about the situation in Ukraine. I also like to thank Toby Fricker from UNICEF and Dr. Jarno Harbich from WHO. I'll keep Sophia for a second because she has an announcement. Then we have an announcement from David and then we will wrap up. Thank you to all the colleagues. Okay, Nina, sorry.
Sorry, I had a question for Jens on another subject.
Yeah, okay. Jens will stay anyway. But let me free those who are, especially those who are on the ground. Thank them very, very much for this briefing. And please come back anytime to brief the journalist here in Geneva. So I think before I let Sofia go, I let her make her short announcement on Women's Day. And then I'll go to you, Nina.
Thank you very much, Alessandra. We already heard about the celebrations of the Beijing Plus 30 during the council that starts next week. But I would also like to make a short announcement that, I mean, as we all know, the International Day of Women, 8 March, is this year a special day, not only because it's the 30th anniversary of the Beijing Platform for Action, but it's also the the 50th anniversary of the International Women's Day that was installed in 1975. And UN Women Geneva are very pleased to partner with you at United Nations office in Geneva, with a number of agencies, member states and civil society, to mark this very special day with a special commemorandum on the 7th of March. So this will take place on the 7th of March in room 19 from 1 to 2. And we will have a special commemoration focusing on intergenerational dialogue and very much looking into how we can push the gender equality issue forward in this pivotal moment through listening to the young people and making sure that we use that we have a concerted collective action in this very, very difficult times for gender equality to push the Beijing Plus 30 agenda forward. So everyone, please join us on 7th of March at 1 p.m. in room 19 for this special commemoration. Thank you very much, and over to you, Alessandra.
Thank you very much. Yes, indeed, we will remind you about the event, and we will all wait for you there. Thanks, Sophia. Thanks for the briefing also on Ukraine. Before I give the floor to David, Nina, you want to ask your question to Jens?
Yeah, sorry. I mean, it was linked to a little bit to Ukraine, but it's the general, I guess, contingency plans by the agencies when it comes to the lacking funding. And we saw after the IASC meeting that Fletcher sent out some comments. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about what specifically is being looked at when, in terms of, I saw he mentioned something about other partnerships for aid and for funding, including 0.7% for each country, which was confusing. I wasn't sure what that meant. If you,
yeah, it's a good question. I will let the. His statement and his message stand on its own. What the priorities that they rallied around at that meeting are now and going forward, including what you mentioned there. As you know, the 0.7% is a very old, I believe, from the beginning of 1970s agreement about how much in international assistance should be giving by developed countries. So it's not a new figure, but it's approaching it in a new way. I think what is important is that this was a meeting where I think it's very clear from his statement that they shook things up and they said, we have to stop looking at all these issues from afar and admiring them and start getting on with it. I think he mentioned also, this is not a drill. Right. So they're very acutely aware of the situation. They are committed to doing something about it and pulling on all levers that they have at their availability. We will hear much more, I have no doubt, in the weeks and months to come, how all of this is going to pan out. The international humanitarian system is very large. It's very large. It has grown over many, many years. There was a lot of self-scrutiny, as he also mentioned in that message, about looking at bureaucracy, how things have gotten slow, and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of I would almost say, self-criticism or self-reflection in there, how to gear the system that is so necessary for the survival of so many people on a daily basis to ensure that that survives.
Absolutely, and I see John has raised his.
Yes, good morning. Can you hear me there?
We can.
Yes. My question is to Jens. Jens, with reference to the Interagency Standing Committee, did the principals also discuss the potential impact of cutbacks by other major donors besides the United States in the pipeline? Thank you.
Thank you, John. I was not at the meeting. It is quite restricted who was at those meetings. I don't have the statement in front of me exactly, but he's talking about the international system being tested. We know that it's not only one donor that is pulling back. And I think many of you have reported on other countries, and I shall name no one, who have recently indicated that they are perhaps not going to be as generous going forward as they have been in the past.
Thank you very much. So I'll conclude now with David Hirsch from ITU. Thank you very much, Jens. And David, you have an announcement.
Yes, good morning. So next week in Abuja, Nigeria, beginning Wednesday, 26th February, extending through Thursday, the 27th of February, Nigeria's Ministry of Communications, Innovation and Digital Economy will host the International Submarine Cable Resilience Summit. The event is being held in association with ANACOM, which is Portugal's National Communications Authority, ITU, and ICPC, the International Cable Protection Committee. For those of you with colleagues in Abuja or around Abuja, beginning in the afternoon on Wednesday, the event is open to press coverage. For those who can't make it to Abuja, there is a webcast to view the conference proceedings. The event will feature panel discussions and expert-led discussions on technical topics such as submarine cable resilience, regulatory frameworks, technological innovation, and managing cable disruptions. A full program is online. Also, for those in Abuja, there's a press conference scheduled for Tuesday morning, about 10 o'clock. Details to follow. That event is being organized by the ministry and will be for physical participation only. It's expected that the event will conclude on Thursday with a summit declaration identifying actions that support submarine cable resilience. Generally, participants will include government and industry representatives, academic and research experts, as well as representatives of UN agencies and other international organizations. We'll send a note to correspondents with practical information that you can use and share with colleagues in the region.
Thank you very much, David. Any question for ITU? I don't see any. Let me see on the pass. Paula Dupraz.
Hi, good morning. Just a question about, I cut out at the beginning of what you were saying, but will there be specific discussion about what's been going on in the North Sea regarding potential disruption to those cables and the source of those disruptions, you know, why that's been happening and, you know, who may be responsible, et cetera?
Yeah, you'll recall the ITU's Deputy Secretary General actually joined the briefing the latter part of last year to talk about the work of the International Advisory Body on Submarine Cable Resilience, for which investigating and or attributing disruptions that happen to submarine cables is not a function or within the mandate of that body. The items that you mentioned specifically are not within the program. It's a technical program based on building out cooperation and the technical aspects of strengthening submarine cable resilience.
Thank you very much, David. I think it's clear. Sorry. So that was our last briefer of today. Thanks, David, for being with us. Good luck with the conference. I only want to remind you the press conference of Wednesday, 26th of February at 11 o'clock by the group of human rights experts in Nicaragua, which will launch their latest report that they will also present to the Council. You've received the invitation.